You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 246.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. We have a really fun interview today, so I just want to get right into it. I was really surprised to learn about how many AJ Jacobs fans we have in the audience. I know there's a lot of people who have actually read the book and have participated in the contest around the book. So I think for those of you who haven't yet, you'll enjoy this interview. And for people who have, you'll enjoy this interview. There's some new stuff. It's not only about puzzles. It's also about probability. It's also about problem solving in general and the process of problem solving, which I really love a lot. So I hope you enjoy. My next guest is the author of this book, The Puzzler, One Man's Quest to Solve the Most Baffling Puzzles Ever, from Crosswords to Jigsaws to the Meaning of Life. AJ Jacobs, you've reached the Local Maximum. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Max. Delighted to be here.
Excited to have you on the show today, and I am really glad that I got a chance to read your book, because it really was a pleasure. First of all, I just want to say
thank you, man.
And I do want to talk. I feel like I don't know if you get asked much about like how to hone your writing style and stuff. So I want to get into that a little bit before we get into the deep question of the puzzles. But like my first question. Well, first of all, let me hold it up. Book is called The Puzzler. Was there an event that occurred in your life that led you to write this?
Well, I was actually working on a totally different book, which is a book. I still like the premise, but the writing it was overwhelming and making me stressed and depressed. So and I'll just tell you what it was. I may come back to it someday. It was all about the post-truth crisis. You know, how do we know what we know? A sort of epistemology. And it was called Fact-Checking My Life. And how do I know the world is round? How do I know that my wife loves me? She says she does. How do I know that the New York Times is more reliable than Fox News? So it was a fascinating topic. But again, I was kind of overwhelmed and I was worried I was going to contribute more to the problem than to the solution. And my agent said he knew I loved puzzles. I'm a lifelong puzzle nerd. And he says, well, why don't you explore that as a book? And I thought, well, yeah, spending 2.5-3 years just doing a deep dive into puzzle nerdery and problem solving and meeting all these crazy, delightful, eccentric people who obsess over puzzles, that sounds pretty good. So that's how I ended up writing it.
So that was quite a shift. And I feel like I'm going to be very negative when putting this question to you. No, I feel like there's kind of a little voice in each of us when we're doing these puzzles, which is like, we're adults. We shouldn't waste our time on this puzzle. This is for kids. What did you have that kind of nagging feeling? And did you feel like there was some good arguments for getting over that, or some good reasons?
Oh yeah. Well, historically there's been this tension between people who say puzzles are a waste of time and the New York Times now has, you know, dozens of puzzles. It's a huge moneymaker for them. But early on, they wrote editorials about how crossword puzzles were a pestilence, and they condemned this other puzzle craze in the 1820s as a monstrous waste of time. And, you know, they saw it as like the crack epidemic. But on the other hand, there's been a long tradition, centuries long, of puzzles as a way to sharpen your mind. That was one of the first puzzle books, was called How to Sharpen the Mind, and how it makes you think in creative ways. So it's not just a joy to do, but it has some redeeming value. And you can guess which side I fall on. They are a force for good. I'm sure there's some rationalization on that, because I've spent so many thousands of hours doing it. But I do believe, just even from my one data point of myself, I think it has helped me be a better thinker and a happier person.
I think you mentioned in one time in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong about the, if I misremember it, but you said there was one point in your life where you either were either quit puzzles or you were thinking about quitting puzzles, and you said, hey, this is going to save how many, this many hours in a week, and I can get this, 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 and this done. And it just didn't work. Is that kind of accurate?
That is fair. Yes. Okay. I at one point thought I would go cold turkey and I just came back to it. And yeah, I thought that I would, you know, be volunteering for Habitat for Humanity and building houses, but instead I was just doing other vices or arguable vices that were worse than puzzle, you know, whatever it was, playing, you know, Angry Birds, which you could argue what was a puzzle in its own right.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about that, and it kind of reminded me of, I don't want to speak for everybody, but our addiction to social media as like, you know, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's not like you're going to quit that and then go immediately into using that time to solve all the greatest problems in the world. But maybe puzzling would be a healthier use of time. I don't know if there's a way to like measure that, but
Well, I certainly think, and you know, there is some science, it's kind of soft science, but that it will make you happy. I mean, there's certainly, I do think social media has the capacity to make you incredibly depressed, but one of the meta puzzles that I think about a lot is, how do I make myself happy? How do I, and not just me, but how do I make myself happy, but also make me a productive citizen who will help make others happy? And I think that is, if you approach that like a puzzle, I find that very empowering. And there's a quote from Quincy Jones, the great music producer, who says, "I don't have problems, I have puzzles." So, which I love, because I think it's a great frame, a great reframe. Problems are very intractable and unpleasant, whereas puzzles are like, it's solution oriented, like, let's roll up our sleeves and figure it out. So trying to reframe problems, crises, arguments as puzzles, I find incredibly helpful, and it makes me happier.
Yeah, I want to get into a few for a second. I always, whenever I have these discussions, always different episodes I did pop into my head. And one of them was, we did an episode on video games. We had a panel of like, you know, successful people who are like, yeah, this is the inspiration I got from my product through video games. And so it's interesting how, you know, sometimes things that were once called a vice, and they could be. I don't know. I feel like video games could be, and it's not like every single thing the New York Times ever called a vice it ends up being a good thing. You have to actually decide what it is or not. But I was actually, it's interesting. I was in, there was a similar story with pinball machines. I was in Asheville, North Carolina recently in the pinball museum, and like they had like, yeah, people were in the 30s just destroying these things and banishing them from their cities. And now, I don't know, I feel like some of these puzzles, though, these kind of thinking games, are actually better for you than some of these other things, which, you know, are maybe neutral, maybe not as bad as people say, but
I agree. Yeah. I mean, I think anything can be a vice if you do it too much. And not every puzzle is as good as another puzzle at making you think. I mean, I have nothing against Waldo. I actually am a fan of those visual puzzles, but I don't think they're going to make you, you know, a brilliant out-of-the-box thinker. Whereas something like lateral thinking or logic puzzles or math puzzles or word puzzles, those all have the potential to teach you lessons. And in fact, I've written I wrote an article for Time and another one for LinkedIn about here are the lessons I learned on how puzzles taught me how to change my thinking. And I'm happy to go over some of them if you want. But
yeah, well, I have a few that come to mind, but why don't we start with an example that you like?
Sure. Well,
maybe it's the same example.
First, there's the meta example of turning life into a series of puzzles. But more specifically, even the phrase "think outside the box," which is now a cliche, I mentioned in my book, it is originally from a puzzle. It is those nine dots on a page. And the puzzle is, how do you connect nine dots using only four straight lines? And the only way to do it is to go outside the bounds of the box. So I do love that. I love puzzles teach you to take a problem and turn it all different ways, even literally upside down. I worked at Esquire magazine for a long time, and my boss, the editor-in-chief, when we had idea brainstorming sessions, would bring in the Heinz ketchup bottle that has the lid on the bottom. You know what I'm talking about? Because, like, you're much younger. But when I grew up, it was like a normal bottle with the lid on the top. But now, if you buy Heinz, the lid is on the bottom. So when you store it, the ketchup is all down at the bottom. So
you don't have to wait.
You don't have to hit the top of the bottom of the bottle. And so literally taking something and turning it upside down can be, and that's, you know, that can be is the assembly line. Instead of the workers going to the car parts come to the workers. So a lot of great ideas are all about reversal. And that's just one of the many lessons that I'm happy to give others, but that's just one example. Do you want more?
Well, no, I mean, a few popped into my head that were in the book. It's the one that it's the one where it's like, move one of the digits to make this math equation true. And it was like a very simple one. It was like, you know, 30 minus 33 equals 3. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And so, you know, I was thinking about the solution to that, and I hate to ruin it for everybody, but the book is full of these. So.
There you go.
So the idea is like, okay, you're allowed to. The solution is you could move one of the digits up and make it an exponent, and that's the solution. And I was thinking about, you know, imagine if you had a really complicated one of these, like some equation that goes on lines and lines and lines, and then it was like, you know, move a digit and make it correct. And I could write a program that does it, you know. I could even write a program that, you know, if there are too many combinations, it could do some kind of smart search and figure out the solution. But if I, as the programmer, can't think outside the box and be like, hey, this exponent thing is one of the allowable moves, then it's never going to solve the problem. And so it's like, you almost need to, it's a type of thinking that requires a certain way of, like, these problems are like the anti-brute force solution. Mm. Like they encourage you to be like, hey, don't bang your head against the wall with brute force. Try to think of a secret or a trap door or something like that. So I
love
I
the
like
anti-brute force framing. And yeah, I think that's it. I think they teach you to get rid of your hidden assumptions, because your hidden assumption, when you hear the word move, you think, oh, it's going to be moving right or left, whereas actually it can also move up or down. So I think that's another thing that puzzles have taught me, is to be wary of words. Because a lot of, especially word puzzles, are all about wordplay. Will Shortz, the crossword editor of the New York Times, his favorite clues are wordplay. His favorite clue, I believe, is something along the lines of, this turns into another story. And the answer is spiral staircase. So instead of story as a like the narrative, it's a story as in levels on a building. So I feel English is, and all languages are, so tricky, because one word can have, the word set, I found this out from my book, the word set has over 600 definitions in the Oxford English Dictionary. That's insane. So it's a very inefficient and confusing language. And that, to me, a lot of problems just boil down to, all right, this word encompasses like 14 different things. Let's break it down and see which one of those we're talking about.
Yeah. The set is an interesting one, because even in, in mathematics, there was like, first they defined set as a collection of objects, but it turned out that that caused all sorts of contradictions. And so now they have all these like axioms and rules on what a set is and what a set is not. And so I could imagine that being quite complicated. One thing I want to ask about is, so you talk a lot in the book about working on these puzzles with your family members, like with your kids and with your wife and all that. And so it occurred to me, like, some of these kind of brain puzzles are things that kind of distinguish it maybe from work or from something where you need expertise. It's like different generations can work together. People who work good in different fields can work together. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, how is it that, like, I feel like people who work in highly specialized fields maybe don't have quite an advantage when it comes to some of these puzzles, even though, I'm remembering the people who do the jigsaw puzzles, but put them aside for a second, like some of these ones that just pop out of nowhere.
Well, I love that question. And there are two points that it brings up for me. First is just the idea of working on a puzzle together. It really is a bonding experience. So this idea of you doing puzzles alone is usually the exception when I talk to hardcore puzzlers. They talk about how it brings them together as a family. And in fact, the inventor of Wordle, Josh Wordle, I saw him speak at the National Crossword Puzzle Tournament, and he talked about how he gets hundreds of emails from people saying Wordle was like a unifying experience. He tells one story about a gay man whose conservative parents ostracized him, and Wordle was what brought them together. So it sounds almost apocryphal, but he seems trustworthy, so I believe him. The second point is, well, I love what you say, a good puzzle will often require different strategies and different types of thinking. So my wife has a company that puts on scavenger hunts, and it's all about team building. And someone might be strong at pattern recognition. Someone might be strong at word play. And you need all of those. And the sort of the extreme example of this is the MIT Mystery Hunt, which you may know about. It's every year and on the MIT campus, 2,000 people come to work on this for 72 hours straight on the hardest, craziest puzzles. And these puzzles, the teams are 50 people, sometimes more, because you need people with different skill sets. You need an astrophysicist, you need a surgeon, you need someone who's an expert in Beastie Boys lyrics, whatever it is. And that, I think, is a lovely. And finally, and then I'll shut up, Cass Sunstein, he's a great legal scholar. He talks about an experiment where people from conservatives and liberals, you put them in a room. One of the few activities that brought them together that they didn't fight about was doing a crossword puzzle. So I'm a little facetious when I say crossword puzzles can save the world. But I think there's a seed of truth to it.
Same thing with Wordle and all the other things you're talking about. And even, even just bringing families together, even if you're not fighting, just something that you could be almost on an equal level.
Exactly. Right.
Do you think, I wrote here, you talk a lot about the psychology of solving these problems, like the different emotions that you go through, and handling that. Did anything surprise you with some of these problems? Like when you dived into it, like, oh, that was a very different experience than what I expected.
Well, it is a far more emotional experience, because you get frustration, you get joy, you get surprise. I will say, in terms of solving puzzles and problems of all kinds, frustration is the enemy. And because I have read some studies that anger, when you get anger, you get tunnel vision, and it impedes your ability to take cognitive leaps, which is what you need for a good puzzle or problem. So there's this psychologist, I have kids, and I watched a child psychologist say, when you're dealing with kids, don't get Don't get furious, get curious. Get curious, not furious. And I love that as a motto for everything, and especially solving problems. You know, try to retain a playful state of mind. And if you get too frustrated, you got to walk away, because the frustration is just going to bring you into this narrow hole where you cannot come up with a solution.
It's interesting. This is the second interview in a row that is related to that topic. Cause I just did an episode on the job search where, you know, my interviewee said the most important thing is to manage your emotional state, your psychology.
Mm, right.
And I'm like, well, now that I'm thinking about it, it seems like that is an important skill for any sort of problem that you're facing. And maybe these puzzles help you practice that in kind of a sandbox way. And I feel like everybody needs to continually work on that, you know?
Oh yeah. I mean, that is a huge thing I work on, managing and sort of almost taking a very bird's eye view of it. So when you're confronted with a problem, say, you know, here are four strategies I could try. Let me see which one works best. And if that strategy doesn't work, let me switch to another strategy. And that's one of my big tips in terms of puzzle solving. Like,
so you write the strategies down beforehand.
Right. Well, sometimes. I guess sometimes. I'm not that organized.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry. Go ahead. Make your point.
One point is, before you start doing the brute force or start, you know, just churning away at a problem, take a step back and say, what would be. So I'll give you an example. It's a famous story, perhaps apocryphal, about the mathematician Gauss. He was like in the 1600s in Germany, and he was 9 years old. And the school teacher said, okay, your assignment today, you might know this. I feel you might know this, but
it's okay. I don't think we've done it in the podcast for at least a good 2 years. So,
all right.
Maybe we've never done it in the podcast, but definitely say this. I feel like you could tell the story very well. Yeah. Go for it.
So the teacher said the assignment for today is to add up all the numbers between 1 and 100. And 9 seconds later, Gauss raises his hand and I says, okay, I got it. And the teacher is incredulous. So like, how could you do it that fast? And the way he did it is he resisted the temptation to do the default, which is, of course, you know, 1 plus 2 is 3, and then add another 3, that's 6, add a 4, and that's 10. Like, that's going to take you a long time. So he took a step back and said, is there a better way to solve this, like a shortcut? And the best method that I know of is what he did. He turned it into pairs. So he realized 1 plus 100 is 101, 2 plus 99 is 101, 3. So all of them equal 101. You have 100 numbers, 50 pairs. So 50 times 101, that's 5,050. Not that hard. So don't jump into a solution when you can just like say, let's pause. And I do this with team building events too. It's like, instead of, you get the scavenger hunt, don't run off and start doing it. Like, pause for 5 minutes and talk about your strategy.
This is again, the theme is, you know, brute force is the enemy. I mean, sometimes brute force is the solution, but it's like, it's teaching you to be like, hey, I can, there's some trick here, that's gonna change my life. That's gonna at least change my outcome of this problem. I love that example. I like to, if I want to teach kids about math and get them interested in it, that's probably one of my, for a certain age, that's like one of my go-to examples.
That's a great one. Yeah, you're right.
So we have to talk about this because this podcast is called The Local Maximum. And the idea of the local maximum is that, you know, you get to a certain point and now every direction you go is down. So you're like, okay, well, I'll stay at this point. But then sometimes you have to go down to reach another peak that's way higher. And I feel like this is a theme that's like all over this book. So maybe you could talk about that for a little bit.
Absolutely. Yes. Sometimes you have to go backwards to go forwards. And And one of the clearest demonstrations of this is I have a chapter. I break the book up into 20 different types of puzzles. So the ones crosswords, which were my first love, but also Japanese puzzle boxes and acrostics and all of these. And one of them was mazes. And I went to what purports to be the hardest maze in the world, which is in Vermont, the great Vermont corn maze.
Yeah. And one thing, just to sell the book a little bit, one thing I like about this book is like it takes you to like all these different places. Like you go to Spain, you go to Vermont, and you go to, you know, it's like I feel like I'm going on a trek. I mean, Vermont here in New Hampshire is not that
That's
exciting,
right.
But you know,
so you're nearby. But, yes, I do. I go around the world. I definitely, yeah. It's not a sitting in place book. But this guy who runs it is hilarious because he is just gleefully sadistic. He loves the fact that people are totally frustrated and it takes them hours and couples bicker and break up and people burst into tears.
God.
He's hilarious. But
and you
anyway,
know what? It's also like, why are we laughing at this? And like somehow it's like, it's just, it's funny.
It is. I think it's because it's self-inflicted pain like that.
Yeah.
That's sort of comedy when you know that it's not real. But anyway, he talks about how he has sort of a trick. It was a bell that he rang, and the bell was at the very end of the maze, and he would ring it, and everyone would just like sheep just go towards the sound of the bell. But that's not the way to solve the maze because it's a maze. You have to go backwards to go forwards. So he was trying to teach people the solutions are not a straight line. Sometimes they are, but the majority of them, you have your local maximums and then you've got your true maximums.
Yeah. Yeah. I was definitely thinking of that most often when it was the maze. I wrote a little story here that is kind of like not a story, but like a series of events that is kind of frustrating. Is the idea was as I was reading that chapter, and the idea was, okay, there's a maze. You're going through the maze. Okay, maybe you get to a few dead ends, but you pretty much go right, you go left, and you see the exit. And you go toward the exit, and you're looking around, and you see, oh look, there's a bridge, and there's a trap door, and there's a tunnel, and there's a zip line. And you go to the end, and just as you get to the end, you win, and that's the end. And you don't get to look at all that interesting stuff. In the, yeah. And I'm like, oh, that's a terrible story. I would hate that. I'd be like, well, what? And it's like, no, if you want to go back in the maze, you got to pay the fee again. You know, like, what?
Right. A good maze is one that takes you on unexpected turns. Right. And there is like...
The end of that story shouldn't be that you just win.
Right. And there is in Maze, there's a joke that I guess, you know, whatever ethnicity, like I guess the French think the Belgians are dumb. So if it's a French person, they'll say a Belgian maze is one where it's just two straight lines. So, you know, that's not fun. That is, you want something that surprises you. So that's another big theme of this book is the joy of surprise, the aha moment.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely lessons in there, probably for like design and storytelling.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think, and I'm not the first to say this, a lot of people I interviewed say puzzles and stories are very similar. You have to have conflict and resolution. You have to have surprises. And Stephen Sondheim, the great lyricist of Broadway, he was also a huge puzzle nerd. And he talked about, yeah, that it provides all of the same satisfaction as a great story. The surprise and the anxiety and the release and all of that. So yeah, very much. It's what we crave. It's what we crave, sort of these aha moments along the way leading to the big aha moment at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. So I want to, I have to talk about this, but I'm about to wade into a part of the book that's a little bit more frustrating epistemology than fun problem solving. But that's the Sleeping Beauty problem, because this is like a probability podcast. So we have to talk about this.
Oh, yes.
Maybe you could start by telling the audience what the Sleeping Beauty problem is and what yeah, has happened. What has happened to the world with the release of this problem?
Well, it is hilarious. I had never heard of it. You, I'm probably have.
No, I had not. I had
is
not
that
even
right?
as.
Oh.
Even as someone who struggled with probability questions for a long time, this is that it was new to me.
That is funny. Well,
although some of the issues around it,
many people have heard of the Monty Hall problem, right? Where you know that one where there are two goats behind the curtains, and
yeah, I mean, even I don't know if the audience has all heard of it, but yeah, that's a more common one.
Well, that's a more common one that involves counterintuitive probabilities. And that one blows my mind, but this one is even more complicated and confusing, and I still have not been able to wrap my mind around it. I am not the only one. The good part is there are mathematicians and philosophers have been debating this for the 30 years it's been around. There have been over 100 philosophy papers about the problem. And it's all about epistemology and you know, multi-universes, and it is just insane. I will give the puzzle. Let me try to find.
Oh,
I hope you edit this a little because I can call up.
Oh, sure.
How I wrote it in the book, if you give me a second. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Let me just do that. All right, I got the book, and now I'll read you
awesome.
How it's.
It's exciting.
All right, so here's how it goes, and again, this is way beyond my. I'm decent at puzzles, but this one blew my mind.
Yeah, well, it's also it was more of a question/puzzle, and I feel like. I have some thoughts on it. Then again, I've only been able to put in a couple days of work, and every time I feel like I've pinned it down, there's like a little bit of doubt. But let's present the puzzle first, and then maybe
all right.
we can talk about.
Sounds
it.
Great. Well, do you want me to? Should I read the Monty Hall one really quickly, or just go straight to? Which
we can
would your
go,
listeners like?
We can go. Maybe we could start with the Monty Hall one. Let's remind people
all right,
of that.
Well, it's short.
That one's nicer because that one you could actually test out. We actually learned that one in high school. You could actually test out and play the game and
right.
see
it
if you get it right or
this
not.
This one so, has a correct answer, and it was made famous by Marilyn Vo Savant, who wrote about it in Parade magazine and in the 80s, and all of these. Professional mathematicians told her she was an idiot, but it turned out she was right. All right, so this one is, suppose you're on a game show. You're given the choice of three doors. Behind one door is a car. Behind the others are goats. You pick a door, say door number one, and the host, who knows what's behind all the doors, he opens another door. So he opens door three, which has a goat. So he doesn't open one, he opens three, and you see a goat. So now you have one and two, which are not open. And he says to you, do you want to stick with number one or switch your choice to door number two? What should you do? Now, my gut instinct is, why would I switch? It's the same thing. And why? It's crazy to switch because it's going to be it's a one and three no matter what. But no, that is not the right answer. The right answer is, yes, you should switch your choice, because what he did is he changed the odds because he knew what was behind that door number three. So now it goes from, what is it? You have a 2 and 3 probability of winning now instead of your initial odds of 1 and 3.
This is like that 1/3 probability from the door he opens gets transferred to the other one because he couldn't have opened your door, you know, so...
Right.
Yeah.
So that one I like. Sorry about the sirens there. I'm in New York
That's
City.
What happens. Yeah. I remember before I moved to New Hampshire, my episodes were full of sirens. So this is the beginning of that. Okay. So there's right, that so one. That's already, I mean, even though it has a straight answer, it's amazing, you know, how many you know, how many people it stumped, which is sort of a lesson to sometimes stay humble about these things. As much as I, you know, my lesson there is, as much as I think I know about probability, it's like, wait, don't jump to conclusions, even if I get that right. But it shows how tough these things can be.
Be humble and be epistemically humble. And also, yeah, don't necessarily trust your gut. Your gut can work sometimes, but in many cases, it leads you astray. Okay, so this is called the Sleeping Beauty problem is, the following. Sleeping Beauty volunteers to undergo an experiment, and she is told that on Sunday she will be put to sleep, and then once or twice during the experiment, Sleeping Beauty will be woken up, interviewed, and put back to sleep with an amnesia-inducing drug that makes her forget that she woke up. All right, so that is Sleeping Beauty. She's in an experiment. She's either going to be woken up once during the experiment or twice, and she'll have no memory. And a fair coin will be tossed to determine which route will be taken. So if it's heads, Sleeping Beauty will be woken up and interviewed on Monday only. If it's tails, she'll be woken up and interviewed on Monday and Tuesday. And then on Wednesday, she's woken up for good. All right. So at any time Sleeping Beauty is woken up and interviewed, she will not be able to tell which day it is or whether she has woken up before. All right. So here's the end of it. The question is, what should Sleeping Beauty say if she is asked, what is your credence now for the proposition that the coin landed on heads? Right. So again, if it's heads, she's woken up once. If it's tails, she's woken up Monday and Tuesday and then woken up. So yeah.
The interesting word there is credence, I think. I feel like that's a word where it's like, okay, what are we talking about here?
What should she believe? Right. What is, and it turns out there is a feud among philosophers of people who think that she should say that it's a 50-50 odds that it was a 1 in 2, basically 1 in 2 versus 1 in 3. So halfers versus thirders, and they hate each other. And there are even subgroups within them, people who try to parse it even more. But anyway, so should she say half? It's half because the coin is fair. So she has no new information.
Yeah.
Then the thirder say, no, she does have new information because think
she's
of it
being
if
woken
she,
up.
Yeah. If yeah. she were woken up, you know, 100 times, then it's more likely it would be, the tails. Anyway, it is mind blowing. What was your take on it?
So I think mine matched yours, but first of all, let's talk about your take first, because you actually had time to seek out other opinions, which I have not yet. So you came down on the third side. Is that correct? Are you still there? Or?
I have, as you say, I try to remain humble. So I would say I have a 60% credence that it is a third and 40%
on 33%.
Yeah, because they're incredibly smart people who will argue brilliantly for both. And it's funny that it's almost like when you're looking at an optical illusion and you can see the bunny and then you can see the old man. So when a halfer is telling me his theory, I'm like, oh yeah, it is half. And then a thirder will say, no, it's a third. And I'm like, oh yeah, it is a third. So you know, I am not sophisticated enough mathematically to know for sure, to have a strong opinion, but my intuition is, yes, it's a third, because one method of solving problems is to ask what it would be like if you almost take it to the extreme. So with Monty Hall problem, you say, well, what if there were 100 curtains and he opened up all of the curtains except for 2? Then it becomes clearer that you should switch. And in this one, you can apply a similar strategy. What if it were 100, she were woken 100 times, then it becomes a little clearer to me that it's half. but I am not certain at all.
You mean one out of 101. If she's woken up once on Monday, or once for heads and 100 times for tails.
Exactly. Oh, and before I turn it back to you, I mean, the halfer that I talked to was a wonderful guy. He was a math teacher, and this literally drove him to the verge of insanity. He spent 2 years, he said, basically staring at a wall, thinking about it, and his wife was freaked out, and it was like, it's almost like the
there are a lot of problems.
Monty,
like
what?
There are some problems like that in mathematics, yeah. Especially.
Right, they're dangerous. It's like Monty Python's sketch about the joke that is so funny it'll kill you. I feel there's a little bit of that.
Yeah, yeah. So I also think it's a third, but it's very interesting. I feel like I need to maintain an open mind in this because before she's put asleep for the first time, I tend to put myself in this position. So before, let's say I'm the test subject. Before I'm put to sleep for the first time, if the coin is the coin has been flipped, but they haven't put me to sleep yet, it's got to be a half at that point. Then it's just when you're woken up, and I think rather than trying to get both sides to settle on an answer, there has to be a way to kind of like dive into the problem and ask, you know, is there kind of a misunderstanding of what's going on? Because the test subject is giving a credence, a belief over, we're assigning probabilities as to what happened. And it's like, well, how do we score that in the end is a good question. And so let's suppose we come up with a method of scoring how well you did, and you want to maximize your average score, you know? So, you know, one way to score it is basically you go through the experiment and whenever you give a probability that gets marked down. And then every time you give a probability, you look at the odds that you placed on the correct answer. So let's say it would be a third if it were heads, and if it's two thirds if it were tails, and then you multiply those together. That could be one way of scoring it, and that's kind of a standard sort of probabilistic score. Like, what was the probability that I assigned to the answer that actually turned out to be correct? So if you use that scoring system, then you get a third. But I could imagine halfers would probably say that's not the right scoring system to use. And I could also imagine, like, this also gets into the question of, like, what's the value of a belief if there are no consequences to that belief? Like, there's no, if you don't have, I still have to say, like, beliefs could be right or wrong, even if there are no consequences, but yeah.
Right.
I feel like there's iffiness in that statement, though. I feel like if you do write your epistemology book, I feel like there are beliefs that are kind of simplifications of the world. Right or wrong might be hard to fit them in right or wrong as well. So
I actually that point very much. That was going to be one of the points I wrote about in my epistemology book is that we're very black and white with the word belief, true and false. And I think that might be a mistake. I think we should think more probabilistically, more Bayesian, and say, you know, there's a 60% chance this is true. I even try to do this in my life, much to my wife's exasperation. So I'll say something, you know, she'll ask, what time will you be home? Oh, there's a 70% chance I'll be home at 6. There's a, 20% chance it'll be much later. But I think that is the way the world works in probabilities. So yeah, I'm with you.
I wonder if your wife could mark down whenever you make such a statement and then see if you are miscalibrated in terms of, people do that on, there's this prediction site. It's not a prediction market. It's just a site called Metaculous, where people put different probabilities on things. And it could be that you tend to have a good signal on which is more likely, like A is more likely than B, but you're kind of miscalibrated. Whereas if you put something at 80%, it's really 60%. If you put something at 10%, maybe it's really 20%. So some people are more calibrated towards the center. Some people are more calibrated toward the end. So it would be interesting to get that data if your family should
100%
get that data.
And well, 100%, that's funny. I do think, yeah, we definitely need to check our predictions much more against what happens. And that is one of the huge problems with the media, is that you've got these pundits who make predictions with zero consequences. And the most popular, the more confident and black and white they are, the more popular they are, because people want that kind of confidence and certainty, even though those are the ones who are far more likely to be wrong.
So, yeah, I agree. I'm trying to think of a follow up, but yeah, no, you're totally right. One of the things I found when reading this book is like I'm just like laughing as I'm going through it, and so I appreciate like, but I don't know exactly why I'm laughing. Like, how did you, I wish I could write in this way, but I write technical documents sometimes, so it's like I'll put in like an inside joke, but it's not going to make anyone laugh. So how did you? Do you have a certain strategy for, coming up with that way of writing, or is that just come naturally to you?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of, points I can make. One is just in terms of not just humor, but making a writing interesting. I think one of the keys is to mix up, I think monotony is what gets people bored. So, anything you can change up is good. Anytime you can change
the unexpected statement.
Well, I'm just talking about length of sentence. Vary the length of sentence. Vary the type of sentence. Vary question. Put question marks, exclamation points in. And this, of course, has tons of puzzles. And so put in those or put in lists. So that is just one trick I use to keep writing interesting. In terms of humor, the overlap between puzzles and humor is huge. And I interviewed one of the original Simpsons writers, Mike Reiss, who's been on it for the whole run. And he's a huge puzzle head. And he says they're very similar, because it's all about, like you say, all about surprise, all about having this one piece that comes at the end that makes sense, but it's also a surprise. And he gives the example of like a puzzle joke, which was the one he gave was a skeleton walks into a bar and says, "I'll take a beer and a mop." And, it's not hilarious, but it does take you five seconds, whatever it is. It takes you a second to be like,
yeah. Hey, what's it's the a puzzle second to want? Figure out? About.
Why is he asking for a beer and a mop? He had another one that was slightly better about towels in hotels. But the point is, yes, it's like
you have to buy the book to get that one.
There you go. But yeah, jokes a lot of times are puzzles that you have to solve. And the solving gives you this unexpected joy that leads to laughter.
Yeah. And that was a selfish question for myself in terms of trying to get back that spark, because I feel like all those years of coding, have been like, it kind of knocks that temptation out of you, because if you're too unexpected while coding, it's fun, right. But it kind of screws up the organization.
That is so interesting. Yeah. It's the kind of the opposite goal.
Yeah.
You don't want surprise.
But
I did, one of my friends who used to write for the Daily Show said that he tries to surprise himself while writing, which is counterintuitive. Like, how do you surprise yourself? You know what you're doing, but you can do it. You can like do a twist at the end of a sentence and be like, "Oh, I didn't expect that." And that is a wonderful feeling when you can do that.
Yeah. All right, that's interesting. I'll think about it. And honestly, I think I could do probably a whole episode on the Sleeping Beauty problem. Maybe bring my co-host on here and we can try to hash that out.
Yeah, so, please don't involve me, because you have gone way beyond. But I can totally,
I'll send it.
I can get you great mathematicians and philosophers who will debate for several days about it.
Oh,
for you.
Well, then that's more than one episode, but yes, I would be interested. All right. So, I think we went through a lot here. I feel like there's a lot in the book that, people have a good taste of what they're going to get in the book. And, I feel like we just had some really interesting, discussions, but, maybe you could tell us any last thoughts about the book, about the discussion today, what you want people to know, and where could they find out more about you? I know I didn't talk about some of your other stuff, which, you know, there's so much interesting stuff out there, but, this is your time to let us know.
Oh, well, thank you. Yes. The book is called The Puzzler. And my website is ajjacobs.com. I will say one thing, that I hid a secret code in the introduction to the book. And there was a contest for $10,000 for first one to crack the code and go on the website and solve these puzzles. So that's over. But the good news is that if you go to the website, you don't even have to buy the book, but thepuzzlerbook.com, and the introduction is there for free, and you can find the code. And if you don't want to bother finding it, I actually have it on the website. You can cheat. But I just want to give it a plug, because if you put that code in, it opens up to a suite of 25 mind-bending puzzles. And they are so creative, and they are, like we said, surprising. So they'll be, you know, combining Sudoku and, I don't know, Chinese checkers. And they're just really creative. I can say that because I didn't write any of them. So I can boast as much as I want. Greg Pliska, a professional puzzle maker, and this, another series of people wrote them. And they are super fun. They're free. And they will give you a taste of this sort of new level of puzzles that you won't see in the newspaper, this that the MIT Mystery Hunt has. And there are hints if you need them. But yeah, give it a shot. Go to thepuzzlerbook.com, even if you don't want to buy the book, which I hope you do, which I hope you do. But those are super fun.
All right. That's very good to know. AJ Jacobs, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Max. Thank you. It was a great conversation. I love talking about the deeper implications of the epistemology and psychology of puzzles.
Yeah. So now you have to get into your new book. You have an assignment. Sorry if that drives you crazy, but
exactly.
Or you could let someone else write it. I don't know.
Oh, and by the way, last thing, you can cut this out, but I listened to a previous episode, which I enjoyed very much. And you referenced my friend Kevin Roos's article in the New York Times about the AI that won the art contest.
Oh, yes.
I just want to say, I'm glad you were positive about him, because he is one of the tech writers out there who really knows what he's doing, and he's thoughtful, and he's not like, he knows the nuances. So I'm a big fan of his.
That's good, because we're not always, sometimes we're very critical.
Yeah, a lot of the media sucks.
Well, that's like one of our, go-to is like find an article and just trash it. Like if we don't have a topic for that day. Yeah. I try to be fair, but you know, I'm doing this on the side. So sometimes I'm just...
Many articles suck because...
Although I would love it not enough people listen to this, but I would love it, like, if an author came back and been like, you're wrong about that. I was right. Blah, 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 blah. It's never happened, but,
It'll happen.
Yeah.
That is funny. Well, yeah. Thank you again, Max. It was a delight to be interviewed.
All right. Thank you very much. That's the show. To support The Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.